There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We've bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it? The other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Rees-Manil, and I'm your host. On today's program, I'll be speaking with Matthew Lassar. He is a media historian who's written two great books on Pacifica Radio, and most recently, he's doing some reporting and analysis of what goes on in Washington at the FCC. He reports for his own website, the Lassar Letter on the FCC, and for the tech news website, Ars Technica. We'll get to why this stuff is important and what some of the most important struggles going on in Washington are. You do want to stay tuned. Matthew, thank you very much for joining me. I've been reading your books, especially enjoyed Pacifica Radio, which is a great history of that venerable institution and recommended reading for anyone with an interest in democratic communications and community radio and how maybe we could have more democratic media. And now you've been working on a website for a number of years, which you called Lassar Letter on the FCC, LLFCC.net. And you've also recently been writing articles for a kind of tech news website, Ars Technica. So maybe you could first tell me a little bit about your website, LLFCC, and how you got into doing it and why.
Well, it's a strange story, but the truth is that I started Lassar's Letter on the FCC. I know it's a rather immodest title, but it's what I called it. Largely because I desperately wanted to stop writing about Pacifica Radio. I had written two books. The second one is 450 pages long about Pacifica Radio, and I needed to get it out of my head. And fortunately, something had happened related to Pacifica Radio that kind of got me in the FCC direction, which is that in 1999, to the horror of me and to a lot of other people, the Pacifica National Board, that Pacifica National Board, which had become very centralized and self-selected, basically became kind of sick of the rest of us, all us annoying Pacificans with our expectations of the network and our expectations of having some input into the network in various ways. And a bunch of executive board members just said, oh, heck, let's just sell KPFA, which is the first Pacifica Radio network radio station created in 1949 by pacifists. And not only that, but they shut the station down because they found us to be very obstreperous. And then the San Francisco Chronicle noticed that, wrote an article saying that they were talking about selling the license. And this, as you might guess, turned the San Francisco Bay Area, particularly Berkeley, into quite a dither, which went on for an entire summer, which I chronicle in my second book about Pacifica Radio. I became very upset at the possibility they were going to sell it. And so I went to the Federal Communications Commission's website, which is a very bad website, very confusing, very hard to understand. But I spent a lot of time on it, and I discovered that there was this thing called the Daily Digest. And if you go to the Daily Digest, it has all the actions that the Federal Communications Commission comes up with every day, and it puts them in this kind of reasonably readable digest form, as opposed to a lot of everything else that the FCC does, which is really confusing. And you can subscribe to it. And I figured I would subscribe to the Daily Digest, and if they really tried to sell the station, I would know right away and call out the troops and we'd stop them. Well, they never did try to sell the station because they were so freaked out by all the hubbub that took place over this that they basically backed down, I'm happy to say. But I became obsessed with the Daily Digest. I never read anything about Pacifica Radio on it, but I read a whole lot of other things, and I realized that there was this whole world in the FCC of all these interesting decisions, regulatory decisions, buying, selling, rules, questions about the FCC's media ownership rules, open proceedings about how to do this, how to do that. And I realized that at least in theory, the FCC is kind of a wonderful thing. It's an open process, or at least it theoretically supposed to be an open process in which the public has the right to comment on a wide variety of important and complex questions about the nation's telecommunications, broadcasting, and internet infrastructure. And I just decided to start a blog in which I would, I gradually mastered the complex process of understanding where you go in the FCC's website to read public filings by corporations and public interest groups and interested parties about various issues. I figured that out, and then I just began writing about all of these filings on this blog, which I had Lazar's letter on the FCC. I started – sorry, I had to cough. I started getting very interested in various things, and I noticed that people got interested in what I was writing. I mean, that I began to fit into a whole matrix of – a whole community of people out there who were writing about these issues. I wrote – length about one proceeding in which religious broadcasters were trying to renege on their closed captioning rules and discovered that there was this whole deaf and hard of hearing community that was quite passionate about this issue, which just constantly wrote to me and asked me for more information. Ultimately, one attorney disclosed to me that my writing about this and my publicizing this issue actually influenced the FCC on what it ultimately did around this issue. And I became convinced that this was a really – I mean, I just really enjoyed writing about it, really enjoyed thinking about it, and just kept on doing it. After a while, I realized that blogging by yourself kind of sucks. The main problem with blogging by yourself is that if you're not Arianna Huffington or somebody with a lot of money – there's only so much of an audience that you're really going to get. I also wanted to be edited. I wanted to be in a community of writers. I didn't want to just be blogging by myself. I started reaching out. I actually wrote on my blog, I don't want to be writing by myself anymore. Found it was very difficult to find other people who write with the frequency and attention that I write. To be immodest about it, I write a lot about the Federal Communications Commission, and I love writing a lot about the Federal Communications Commission. And had a lot of false starts with various people who I tried to partner with, contacted a bunch of commercial sites, most of whom didn't really – who at first they were interested in me, and then they saw my politics, and they weren't so much – they weren't so much interested in me. I mean, I don't consider myself to be a radical left-winger, actually. I see myself more sort of a pro-regulatory liberal, but even that apparently is too much for a lot of FCC-related sites. And finally, somebody got me in contact with Ars Technica, and it's really a perfect fit. It really is a wonderful, wonderful website full of people who are very dedicated, very knowledgeable about their fields, and who are equally passionate about writing these things. Writing about this stuff, I particularly am referring to Eric Bangerman, the managing editor, and Nate Anderson, both of whom are really great writers. And I feel right at home there. And now LLFCC, my blog, is really just a kind of a place where I point people to what I'm writing to on Ars Technica. And they pay me, and that's another really good thing. And so I'm quite happy to be writing for them. In fact, as you have me here, I'm just finished one story, and I'm on to the next. I'm in the middle of the next Ars Technica story, and I'm going to finish it up after this interview.
I think that's pretty unique that Ars Technica is actually interested in the kind of topics you want to cover. I mean, I think they're important, and I think my route to getting interested in these issues sounds a lot like yours. I didn't come in necessarily through Pacifica, but I came in through interest in community radio, interest in community media, and noting, you know, how the regulatory structure supported and didn't support the expansion of more democratic communications. And I started blogging about it too, simply because I felt like I had to share these things I learned. And I know all about the Daily Digest and reading it every day and picking out little tidbits to share. And I think it's great though that Ars Technica, which does do, you know, kind of some insidery reporting in addition to what you do, and that they're interested in doing it, and they can actually, you know, make some money at it, because that seems a bit unusual So much of tech writing, I find in online, tends to be very trend related. What's the newest gadget? You know, who can get the newest scoop on what Apple's coming about? And seeing this kind of somewhat more hard hitting writing and journalism is sort of unique. I mean, what do you think is the key to that at Ars Technica?
Well, Ars Technica does do a lot of product review. They do a lot of product review. They do a lot of what the latest thing is coming from Apple and what and all that. And frankly, that you know, there's a big audience for that. And I certainly think that it's understandable that they would that they would target that audience. I think that I don't actually know specifically how, you know, their marketing strategies and everything like that. But I think that to a large extent, that kind of writing in some way subsidizes the very detailed writing and pay and attention that they pay to important regulatory issues. Not just at the FCC, they do a lot of great stuff about the European Union. They do a lot of great stuff about copyright, antitrust, all kinds of legal tussles. And one of the great things about Ars Technica and the writers there is that they don't just read the press release. You know, they don't just read what, you know, the first five lines of some telco's press release. They really go out there. They get the legal opinion. They get the FCC filing. They get the lawsuit filing. They go out of their way to find that stuff, and they go out of their way to read all 379 pages of it or whatever it is and summarize it and figure out what's really going on. Really, it's not like the tradition. It's not like the, you know, the usual – I don't want to name any names of the of our competitors, but it's not like the usual companies that basically just give you the press release and a few details. They really go out of their way to give you an in-depth look at what's going on. And, you know, it's why I really enjoy writing with them and really admire these guys.
Yeah, you know, I'd read Ars Technica in the past, although not with any regularity, and it was seeing your writing there that caused me to start looking at the site on a nearly daily basis again, and was really impressed by the writing, not just that you're doing, but that your fellow writers are doing there. What kind of reaction are you getting now from readers? Are you finding that you're definitely hitting a larger audience? Are you getting more reaction?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, larger audience. Oh, my goodness. I mean, the other day, a friend of mine wrote to me a really funny email. She said, you know, I think I was going to send you this really, really good story about the FCC's 700 megahertz auction, except that I noticed that it was written by you. And I thought that was, you know, that was great. I mean, I really, you know, I thought that was really the best compliment that I'd gotten in a long time. I think that it's you know, Ars Technica has a very, very large audience, an audience that is very, very focused, I think, on working and living within the realm of broadband and PC related technologies, is very interested in media regulation. In all the complex ways that it now manifests itself today. One of the things that I find interesting about writing for Ars Technica, and the thing that I find the most challenging, is that a large portion of its audience, my impression is that a large portion of its audience is pretty young, a lot younger than me. I'm 53 years old. And a lot of its audience has kind of left so-called legacy broadcasting technologies behind. That's a nice way of saying terrestrial radio and television. These are all people who get it all from their self, you know, from their extremely elaborate iPod, iPhone, personal handheld device, whatever things. I mean, they think that when I write about radio, some of them think it's quaint. I mean, yeah, I wrote an article about AM and FM and the question of whether AM should be allowed to have FM translators. Mm-hmm. You know, you get comments like, I hate, is there still AM? there's still AM radio? I hate, or, you know, I hate AM radio. It interferes with the reception on my iPod. You know, I mean, people, they have, it's an audience of younger people, and it matches my students at UC Santa Cruz. I should also mention that I teach at UC Santa Cruz. It matches my students at UC Santa Cruz, many of whom have left terrestrial media behind. They get it all from their computers. They get it all from their personal handheld devices. In fact, I see them sneaking looks at their personal handheld devices while I'm lecturing. You know, they're all getting their little Facebook, base, whatever, MySpace, Friendster, iNet, networking, little messages on their personal handheld devices or whatever it is that they're getting on their devices as I speak. And I don't take it personally. I think a lot of them are kind of addicted to these devices, and they actually tell me that they kind of hate it. They hate that they can be reached 24/7. I say, well, why don't you just turn them off? But they are really you know, a big part of that audience. And you know, for me, I write about the stuff that's going on right now in broadband. You know, I write about the 700 megahertz auction. I write a lot about the big white space fight. I just wrote another piece about the white space fight between all these broadcasters and Google's, which I think is going to go up on Ars Technica any minute now. I'm writing right now about the FCC's new proceeding on why the so-called public safety D block of the 700 megahertz auction failed. But I also write a lot about indecency regulation at the FCC, which is a very troubled area of the Federal Communications Commission right now. And I write a lot about, and as you noted, I wrote this article about National Public Radio. And it's very, in my opinion, hostile attitude towards low power FM, which I find, I mean, I understand that National Public Radio and the National Public Radio Service is a very big service that serves a lot more people than low power FM. But there was a kind of a gratuitous, almost social Darwinist hostility to NPR's attitude towards low power FM that I found a bit off-putting. And that's why I wrote that article. That was a very popular article. On Ars Technica, and got around to a lot of other places.
Well, it seems to me that in a lot of ways, between media ownership and then issues around net neutrality and now wireless regulation has given kind of a shot in the arm to the reform community, to the media reform community, and it seems like uniting with tech companies and with techies and with you know, people who are very much online has been a real boost, you know, and it's starting to get them thinking about how things like the FCC does matter and does unite with their concerns of whether or not they can download BitTorrents or have the freedom to communicate online. And so are you seeing a lot of that in your audience with Ars Technica?
Well, I think that there is a wide range of opinion. And Ars Technica. I mean, this is basically from reading the comments. There's a wide range of opinion at Ars Technica among the audience about regulation. The audience is by no means, I think, unanimous about net neutrality, unanimous about white space, or unanimous about any of these issues. Most people, I think, are very pro net neutrality, especially the people who use the bookmarking. Who bookmark Ars Technica articles on Gig and the /dot crowd. If people out there know who that is, /dot is an important website that I think started out as a Unix-related website and has branched out to a lot of other issues. I think that there's a lot of support in those areas, but it's not by any means unanimous. I think it's true that this alliance, I mean, one of the ironies of the media reform movement at this time is that it's constantly talking about stop big media and constantly talking about corporate influence. And yet at the same time, it is forced to make alliances with important corporate players like Google and other important and other related important players. And the reason for that is simply because it's the only way to do it. Broadcasting telecommunications regulation issues in American history almost never get to the front burner of American politics, especially in an election year. I've never seen it happen. I teach United States history, and I've never seen it happen in terms of my reading of United States history. I don't think that the media reform movement can really get much, much further than it's getting now unless we've got a Democrat in the White House. I'm sorry for these funny little AOL instant messenger sounds. I don't know how to get rid of them. But anyway, I don't think that we can get much further than we're getting now without a Democrat in the White House. We've got a 3-2 situation at the Federal Communications Commission right now, 3 Republicans and 2 Democrats. And while FCC Chair Kevin Martin has been intriguingly supportive in some ways of the net neutrality question of late, particularly in the controversy over Comcast's downgrading of BitTorrent applications, blocking of BitTorrent applications, I don't think you can go a lot further than that without a Democrat in the White House. And that's why I express some occasional irritation, impatience with the constant declaration that media reform is a bipartisan cause. It's not really a bipartisan cause. There are some Republicans who occasionally get on board, but the overwhelming majority of advocates for media reform are people in the Democratic Party or to the left of the Democratic Party. I mean, yeah, you got Trent Lott and you got Olympia Snowe and you got a couple of other people who occasionally show up. But when the rubber meets the road in big votes over media ownership questions, the Republicans overwhelmingly vote for media consolidation and the Democrats overwhelmingly vote for media reform. And somebody does occasionally need to point that out.
Well, you've mentioned a number of issues that you've been covering recently. What is the thing that worries you the most, or what is the issue that maybe even personally you pay the most attention to right now?
Well, I think that the question of media ownership is really important. There's a trio of issues. One of them is media ownership. One of them is forbearance, which is one of these really bad words that puts people into a narcoleptic coma as soon as you start talking about it. You know, one of the problems with media regulation is that a lot of the issues are so obscurely labeled that it is really difficult to explain to people why they're so important. But media ownership reform, forbearance, and obviously net neutrality are really important. One of the things that I found most disturbing about the 700 megahertz auction, which recently concluded, big companies, especially Verizon's, paid almost $20 billion for a whole bunch of broadband spectrum, which they're going to use across the United States to roll out the next generation of broadband services, so-called 4G band services, is that the overwhelming majority of that spectrum was bought by a relatively small number of companies. And at first glance, 0% of them were owned by women, and 0.5% of them were owned by minorities. And what that tells me is how little, marvelous new opportunities in the world of broadband. It's just as conglomerated and difficult and inaccessible to ordinary Main Street entrepreneurs as traditional legacy media. And it really concerns me. It really concerns me how undemocratically this is all getting rolled out. Everybody's while waiting to see whether Verizon, which bought the so-called C block section of the auction, in which all platform devices are going to have to be, in which all that wireless space is going to have to be accessible to all kinds of platform devices, not just the ones that Verizon uses. It's unclear now from Verizon statements whether it's really going to honor the C block. But those kind of issues, whether or not they're going to honor the C block, whether or not the big telcos are going to be continuously compelled, as per the Telecommunications Act, to open their local loops to smaller providers. Those are the only ways that different people than the people who run AT&T and Verizon are ever going to have access to the system. And right now, the FCC is pretty asleep at the wheel on these issues. And the reason for that is because of the lopsided partisan nature of the FCC right now. So the question really is very important: who's going to be president of the United States? I think that if Barack Obama was president of the United States, or even less so but not insignificantly Hillary Clinton was president of the United States, you'd see a much more attentive FCC to those matters. And I think that this is all very rooted in partisan politics, and that can't be ignored.
No, I agree with you there. Although I will mention that Clinton was president in 1996 when a Telecom Act passed.
Although, that's absolutely true.
Although the difference between now and then, I would argue, is that these issues were much more under the radar and much more obscure, and there was far less public knowledge and discussion about media ownership and related issues, and especially about broadband, which where a lot of policies were set then than is now. And
yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I think that Clinton, you know, Clinton was at that point very floored by the Newt Gingrich contract with America Revolution, and I think it really took him aback, and he saw his strategy as basically collaborating and compromising with it, and that's one of the reasons why he signed the Telecommunications Act. I think that since then, a lot of Democrats have realized what a mistake some of the provisions in that act were. Not all of the provisions in that act, some of a lot of the things. I mean, when people talk about the Telecommunications Act, particularly on the left, they just say it was this terrible thing. And I don't think they really understand that there were a lot of good things in the Telecommunications Act.
Sure.
Around, you know, opening up you know, opening up the big telcos to wholesale access. It applied the Americans with Disabilities Act to telecommunications, which was very important. And it did some other good things too. And so not everything was bad, but the clear, you know, the opening up, there were two things that it did that were truly atrocious. The first was, of course, most famously, relaxing the nation's radio ownership laws so that Clear Channel and a few other stations, that's too few other networks, can basically, if not completely dominate all the radio stations in the United States, dominate the vast majority of advertising revenue that radio stations generate, which FCC studies show that in lots of areas of the United States, two companies basically dominate 70-80% of all the advertising revenue, which has a devastating impact on localism in all of those areas. And the other thing that it did was it forced the Federal Communications Commission to, at first, every 2 years, reconsider its media ownership rules, which has resulted in an ongoing civil war at the FCC. I mean, the FCC was never really equipped. They didn't give the FCC more money, more resources for this enormous task. Finally, in 2004, in a congressional writer, they said, well, we'll make it every 4 years. And, you know, Kevin Martin, I think, although I don't like his the decision that he pushed through the FCC in early November, relaxing the FCC's newspaper TV cross-ownership rule, you know, that was a much more modest rule than what Michael Powell came up with in 2003. Nonetheless, this has really opened up a Pandora's box within the Federal Communications Commission, and it has created this kind of Byzantine process about deciding the nation's media ownership rules. And so that's one of the reasons why I think this is something that really needs to be dealt with by Congress and not just sub rosa at the Federal Communications Commission.
Well, we're about out of time here, so I really appreciate your taking a moment to tell us more about this. And your website, of course, is llfcc.net. And
you know what? If you just type LLFCC anywhere in a search engine, you'll come right to my site.
Come right to it. And of course, you've been writing for Ars Technica, which is ArsTechinica.com. Is that correct?
That's right. Great site.
Where you can read not only your writings, but other writings that have to do with regulation and other important political economic issues about online technology and our media. And I hope you'll want to come on again to talk with us.
It's my great pleasure to talk with the great Paul Rizmandel of Media Geek about these questions.
Well, thanks a lot, Matthew.
Thank you.
That was media historian and FCC analyst Matthew Lessar. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'll be back in 1 week with more news and views in our media environment. Of course, in the meantime, you can check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net, home to the Media Geek blog. Download the program at radio.mediageek.net, or you can subscribe to the podcast there or listen to it in your browser. It's all there at mediageek.net. If you have any comments about the program, please send them to me, paul@mediageek.net. Thanks for tuning in.